Man, I tell you what, I saw that cat at the beginning of this movie. I was like, is it going to start narrating?
They say the war tore a hole in the sky. Only a few survived.
Is that going to happen again? Are we going to have another fallen situation? I was real scared. I was like, if that cat starts talking and it has Denzel's voice.
That was 30 winters ago.
I think I know exactly what kind of movie we're in for.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Let's be honest here for a second. If a movie has Denzel in it and opens with a cat, the mainstream is not quite going to love it, but it's going to be fucking awesome.
That's true. And they're going to write a whole batch of new screenplay books called Zell the Cat, and it's going to be amazing. Speaking of amazing, you've just tapped into Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. We wander the cinematic wastelands. We collect the discarded reels of movies that no one...
Detritus.
The detritus of film. The detritus of cinema past. Dust it off and we give it a second look. Dig our teeth into it, no matter what flaws it may have. And then at the end, to perfectly round out the experience, pair it with a junk food perfectly tied to that film.
Oh, God. Oh, dear God.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dear God. Oh, yeah. You know what? In your intros, you never sell that's what we do. Like, it's just the cherry on top of junk food cinema. But now that you're selling that after the cat discussion... Fuck, Brian. Jesus. Now I've got the sort of Damocles hanging over my head for the rest of this fucking episode. Like, where is he going to go? Is it going to be simple like a hot dog, or is he going to go really, really like wrong? All right.
Well, so I jump we'll off there. The Heathcliff. We'll find out. We're on filmschoolrejects.com. You can find our back episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter, in fact, twitter.com/junkfoodcinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. I'm Brian Salisbury. He's C. Robert Cargill, Lieutenant of Megaforce.
And together, we are Junk Food Cinema.
Junk food powers activate. Form of that new awesome taco at Taco Bell that has a fried chicken shell.
Shape of a DVD box set.
Yay! That's... Wow. That kind of encapsulates our entire show.
It kind of encapsulates our entire life.
In one Wonder Twins reference. That is both horribly uplifting and terrifyingly sad at the same time.
Much like this movie.
Much like this movie. Now, this is where...
What an unplanned segue.
Well, this is where being a patron really pays off, because the reason we're doing this movie is because of a revelation that came to light during a patron minisode. We were doing our top five January releases, I believe, was the subject.
Top five January. You came up with some batshit narrow fucking band of top five... January releases that have come out since 2010, which allowed us to talk about a bunch of, you know, underrated gems. And so we had our top five list, and we get to my number one movie. And it's Book of Eli.
Our only hope is in my hands. Some would kill to have it. I will kill to protect it.
Book of Eli.
And you don't have Book of Eli on your list, and I was giving you a lot of mad shit about it. Just like
you took Dolores Umbridge with the fact that I did not have it on my
list. Like of the, I mean, you put a. If I remember correctly, didn't you put like a Resident Evil or a?
No. I put Legion.
You put Legion on that list, and I was like, you have fucking Legion on that list, and you don't have Book of Eli on that list. I am truly offended. And you're like, yeah, because I haven't seen it, and I flipped my shit. I flipped tables. I was like, how the fuck have you not seen Book of Eli?
This place was a mess when you were done. So many tables flipped over.
I mean, come on. You are a huge fan of post-apocalyptic movies.
That I am.
You are a huge fan of Denzel Washington movies.
That I am. Okay.
Yes. Tom Waits is in this fucking movie. Gary Oldman's in this fucking movie. Like, there's so many reasons you could have, so many excuses you could have made for if there was anything keeping you from seeing this movie. You could have gone, yeah, but Gary Oldman's in it, so I have to watch it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but it's got Tom Waits in a great cameo role, so I have to watch it. Like, there's any number of things you could have come up with to go, you know what, I'm going to stay up and have a couple beers and watch this movie, and you had not. It is 2017. It was January of 2017 when you made that revelation, 7 years after we got this movie.
No, I get it. It's a major character flaw, and it's a shortcoming of mine for
However,
sure.
However, in talking about it, you and I said, hey, you know what? Just 2 months ago, I sat down and righted a cinema wrong. And I watched a movie that I hated for 20 years and rewatched it and completely changed my opinion on it. Completely flipped. So I was like, this is your chance for redemption.
Yeah.
And this is Brian's junk food redemption. He is seeing a movie that I am ashamed to know that a friend of mine has not seen.
And here
okay.
We are.
Okay.
Where did you learn about Eli? From the Bible? This,
so let's talk about this.
Let's talk
way,
about it. Yeah.
Before we go any further.
Yes.
If you have not seen Book of Eli, there are going to be two major spoilers here that you have to be willing to embrace if you have not watched the movie. If you're like, why are these guys going on about this movie? I've never seen it. It doesn't sound that great. Or I've heard this part of it. Or I've heard this part of it. And you need that selling, by all means, stick with us. But we are about to spoil two major bits, probably in the next 2 minutes, that if you had any plan on seeing it, pause this episode. Watch it fucking immediately. Because it is fucking great. Like, even if you don't enjoy it, you're going to admire several of the aspects of it and what they do with it. But do not let us spoil it for you unless you are just like, I wasn't planning on watching it. And then hopefully by the end of this, you'll be like, oh, holy shit, that's what that movie is? Fuck, I want to watch that movie. So let's get into it.
Let's get into it. First, we drop the bomb and we ruin all of humanity. It's gone. 30 winters ago, because winter is indeed coming, and it's been here and gone 30 times since what we're led to believe is just, I mean, and this is in the grand tradition of post-apocalyptic movies being very vague about the thing that happened that caused the situation that we're in now. Usually there's a scroll that says something like after the Great War, and there's one trumpet playing, and okay, I'm talking about after the fall of New York.
Or like Road Warrior, after the gas wars.
The guzzoline.
Like, what the fuck were the gas wars?
That's when they used up all the guzzoline.
Who the fuck cares?
Well,
it's,
I don't know.
It's fucking, you know, Mad Max 2. Let's go. Yeah, but that is also part of what this is. This movie is like, yeah, we're being really vague about it because most of the people who were around when it happened were really young and are old people now, and everyone else doesn't really know much about the world. So much so that a single book contains knowledge that is dangerous.
Yeah, and we're not
protected.
We're not just talking about 50 Shades of Grey. Although I think after the end of humanity, they will look at that book and go, "Oh, that's why."
Oh, and you know what? It's funny. I guarantee you, had 50 Shades of Grey come out before this movie was made, that would have or had been a big hit, at least before this movie was made. That would have been one of the books dumped onto the table as well. There's a little joke in there where they, because this essentially the major plot is we've got this guy walking around carrying a book, mm-hmm. and we have a villain who runs a small town in the post-apocalyptic wasteland, who's looking for a very specific book. It doesn't take a mathematician to put two and two together and figure out that these paths are going to cross.
Starring Denzel Washington as LeVar Burton. You don't have to take my word for it.
It's Geordie LaForge. No, so they're going. They're going to collide. But at one point before this happens, A group of raiders kill a couple on the road while Denzel Washington is nearby. They take their stuff, they show up, and they dump it out on the table for the boss, and it's a bunch of books. And in that pile of books is the Da Vinci Code. A, you know, little riff on the fact that in, you know, when this movie came out, that was probably the paperback you were most likely to find if there had been an atomic war. Like, everyone had a copy of the Da Vinci Code.
Even that uncle of yours who doesn't read much had a copy of the Da Vinci Code.
No, it was like in the 90s, where if you were a teenager at any time in the 90s, no matter what point in the 90s, you owned a copy of The Downward Spiral. Like, that is just a thing every household had. You had Nine Inch Nails, The Downward Spiral.
I was going to say, wait, I was like, that's a book? I thought it was just a Nine Inch Nails album.
No. You had in the 90s, okay. Well, we were like fuck books in the 90s. We have these new computers, and we'll eventually be able to read computers on books, man. We go and watch movies, and we read books.
Hack the library.
But so, yes. So, yeah, there's the, you know, and there's a bunch of, like, you know, little in jokes of the books dropped there. But so let's go back for a second. You mentioned this at the beginning of the episode. I wanted to start off this way. But so I'm just going to roll back there. The opening shot of this film is one. I cannot think of a post-apocalyptic movie with a better, more scene and world establishing shot than this shot. Like, people will, you know, people talk about how the Mad Max films, at least most of them, are the best post-apocalyptic films ever made.
And it should be said that the Hughes brothers who directed this are certainly fans of Mad Max, because the moment you mentioned with the people being murdered on the side of the road feels like a scene directly from Road Warrior, and I kept thinking of that scene as I was watching it.
Oh yeah, no, there's definite Road Warrior vibes to this in a different way, but yeah, this shot tracks across, like, it's so expertly done. It's tracking across a forest. Trees are leaves are falling. You think it's leaves, it could be ash. You're not entirely sure. It's tracking across, and we see a gun. And then it tracks across, and we see a hand, and we're tracking across a body, and there's a dead body there. Whose is it? We don't know. How long has it been there? We're not entirely sure. But then this hairless cat emerges from the woods, still in this tracking shot, you know, this pan. And the cat comes up and goes and starts smelling the body. And we track off, and we hear the sounds of the cat eating, and we're still tracking across the forest and tracking. And then we see boots, and we track up, and we see someone with a bow and arrow. And then we have our first cut, and we're looking at the person with the bow and arrow, and they loose it, and it fucking nails the cat.
Yeah.
In what is essentially the fifth or sixth cut in this movie, we've killed a cat.
Yeah,
like, this is a thing that it's not exactly a dog, but you still don't fucking do it.
Yeah,
but they've done it and established that in this one moment, this is the world that we live in. We live in a world where somebody actively is hunting a cat for dinner. And then in the next scene, he's cooking the cat and he's licking his fingers and it's delicious. Like, this is what food has become. Cat meat is a feast.
Yeah. A fancy feast, you might say. And in a very simple but direct way to tell the audience that the world is fucking topsy and turvy, he then feeds part of the cat meat to
a mouse.
Yeah. Bill Murray should be, this is where the part where I should drop in some Bill Murray.
Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Because it is mass hysteria. Anarchy has come. The world is done.
But, again, that's one of those classic screenwriting tricks right there. That's saving the cat with the cat. It's a little joke.
Saving the cat for dinner.
By the way, we mentioned that the Hughes brothers directed this, and we'll get into the Hughes brothers a bit more in a bit. This movie was written by Gary Whitta. This was his first big sale, as far as I can remember. Gary Whitta was a guy that at the same time that I was a film critic over at Ain't It Cool News, he was a video game critic over at IGN and wanted to get into novels and screenwriting. and wrote The Book of Eli.
And just wrote a little movie called Rogue One.
Yeah, he has one of the story credits on it. He was one of the first writers on it. And of course, being a studio Star Wars film and one that got taken over weirdly at the end, a lot of his stuff, I'm sure, is gone now, which is why he only has a story credit. But yes, he worked on Rogue One and is working on a ton of amazing stuff. Like, oh my God, he's making Mouse Guard, the movie coming up here soon. For speaking of post-apocalyptic, this is just the flip side of that. It's mice in the 12th century protecting their warren from invading cats and other assorted woodland monsters. Really great comic book, so I can't wait for that. But so this is Gary Iwata being cute and clever. He is saving the cat by feeding the cat to a mouse. Like, this is a little in-joke here.
Fuck your rules.
So already we know that this guy has a heart. He just needed to eat. He's not some cruel cat-killing bastard. He is a human being in the wasteland. Like, in fact, we see this the first time we see him smile, and one of the only times we see him smile in the whole movie is when he's found a man hanging in a closet, and he feels around and finds boots. And the boots are in great shape, and he tries them on, and they're a perfect fit. And he starts walking around, and you see the smile on his face as he's wearing comfortable shoes for the first time in God knows how long. Like, this is the simple pleasure, the only simple pleasure that really allows him to smile through this whole movie. And from then on out, this is downhill for Eli, man. Shit does not go well for Eli.
This may well be called Book of Job.
Yeah.
That's how bad things go for
him. And that's very much what this movie is. So let's talk about the book.
Yeah, okay. So this is what's interesting is that after we had this discussion on our Patreon episode and we're like, okay, we got to do Book of Eli now. I got to see it and we got to talk about it because 2009 was a very interesting year for post-apocalyptic films. One of the biggest ones being, of course, Zombieland that came out. But I want to say,
This was 2010.
It was released in 2009. Oh, no, you're right. 2010, excuse me.
That's how it was on our list.
That is how it was on our list. But what it was, I guess it was 2010 was the year. I just remember that year seeing that trailer and being like, wow, there's a lot of post-apocalyptic movies coming out this year.
Yeah.
And so we talked about it and we're like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to see it now. And I told you, I was like, well, I'm a little bummed out because someone already spoiled the twist for me. And you were like, oh, well, that's too bad. And I was like, yeah, I already know it's the book that he's carrying around is the Bible. And you were just like, that's not the twist.
Yeah. I was like, oh, that's not the twist. That's kind of the point of the whole movie. Like, it's the movie very subtly starts feeding you breadcrumbs about what it is. And you can put it together very quickly, or you can wait until minute 45 when they're pretty blatant about it, or if even when it's not blatant, you can wait till about an hour and 15 minutes in when we finally see the cover of the book and you're like, oh shit.
Well, Mila Kunis, who's in this movie, which by the way, I kind of think they should have gone all out and made one of the books that the henchmen bring back to Gary Oldman as he's looking for the Bible, Twilight. Because apparently Kristen Stewart was supposed to play the role that Mila Kunis is playing, but she couldn't because of Twilight commitments.
Oh my God, that would have been so good.
Right? Just to be like, oh, fucking Twilight, are you kidding me?
Oh, Jesus. Like, that makes a whole lot. Like, Mila Kunis in this is one of the oddest pieces of casting of this movie. Like,
I don't think she's bad in it, though.
No. I said odd.
Yeah.
Not bad. Like, yeah. Mila Kunis is a fantastic actress. She does everything she's supposed to do. She's lovable. She's adorable. She gets you endeared to her. She's entertaining even in throwaway pieces of fluff like Friends with Benefits.
And she made you almost not want to hate Max Payne.
Wait, so is Friends with Benefits the one she's in?
No Strings Attached?
No, okay, she's in Friends with Benefits. No Strings Attached is the other one.
Okay.
Those are the two movies that came out that were the exact same movie at the exact same time, except one of them was about a girl who was essentially autistic, but they never said.
It's the Armageddon of Deep Impact of fucking your friend.
Yes, yeah. And so, but that's Mila Kunis, the only issue with Mila Kunis here is the Hughes brothers were, because it's post-apocalyptic and because the idea was that everything that happened right at our time. You know, it essentially the bombs went off in 2010. Mm-hmm. Everything that was left behind was what was stylish in 2010. So even though it's 30 years later, you know, Mila Kunis is walking around in super hip sunglasses and a scarf and a nice jacket. And she looks like she's on the set of, a perfume commercial. While Denzel Washington looks like he hasn't showered in weeks. Like in every shot of this movie, and is wearing it on his face. Like he just, I don't know what he did, if he's method about it, or if it, you know, I mean, he is one of our greatest living actors, if he just carried it, but he looks exhausted this entire movie. Like he's just tired.
Probably from the 50 pounds he lost for this role.
Possibly.
That motherfucker probably is tired and hungry and wants to go home.
Yeah, so he just looks tired. But yeah, so she's the oddest piece of casting here. But thinking of Kristen Stewart is who this role was written for. Like Mila Kunis just seems like, you know, in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, it's like, what is a girl essentially the platonic ideal of the Hollywood 20-something. Like just this incredibly beautiful, whereas you have someone like Kristen Stewart who is, you know, incredibly beautiful, but has that awkward nature to her that makes her feel more accessible and more like, you know, a girl in the wasteland. And she can also dress down and be attractive, but not be like, what is this insanely hot girl doing out here single in the middle of...
You got your hotness in my apocalypse.
Well, keep in mind that we're talking about a post-apocalyptic wasteland where we've got all of these guys running around raping pretty much every woman they see. Like, there are three...
I think we're being generous just saying women at this point in the
there
apocalypse.
Are... Well, but no, the movie is, you know, there are three attempted slash rape scenes. They never show anything. They never carry on. Like they hint at that these are going to be rapes. And, you know, we don't really have one of them turn into, oh, yes, someone's about to get raped until the third one, which we see a guy about to undo his pants. But the movie saves itself by putting an arrow straight through the guy's dick.
shot through the dick and you're to blame. Oh my God, it hurts. You just shot me in the dick.
Really, you know, it really is a dick shot.
Butters, you don't shoot a guy with an arrow in the dick. Come on, man.
So yeah, but Kristen Stewart does seem like a better fit for what the Hughes brothers are doing here, because with the rest of this cast, they were going for, you know, thespians, even off roles. There's a role in the, you know, like small little like bit roles. You have big, you know, big actors. You have Michael Gambon.
Yeah. Okay.
Walking on as a cannibal towards the end of the fucking
Eli
movie.
Shows up at the door of this house and motherfucking Gandalf's got a 12 gauge in his face.
No, motherfucking Gandalf has a wily fucking coyote trap.
I said,
and then,
wait a minute. I said Gandalf. Dumbledore puts a fucking shotgun in his face.
Yeah.
And you almost blows Gandalf, my credibility out the back of the theater.
Gandalf.
Gandalf. What's
Gandalf.
The matter? Dumbledore.
Yeah,
sorry
no,
about that.
But so he's got a Wile E. Coyote trap.
He does have a Wile E. Coyote trap.
And he drops into a Wile E. Coyote trap and then has a 12 gauge on him.
But you know, it's not from Acme because that trap actually worked.
Yes, it did.
It's an important point of distinction.
But yeah, so Michael Gambon is just, you know, like, and this movie does this constantly. Like there are just these, you know, character actors. You know, we have Tom Waits who shows up as a shopkeeper for like three scenes.
One of the things I wanted to do was eat people.
And he's the engineer.
Yeah.
You know, he's referred to as the engineer, like he's a shopkeeper, but he's the engineer. And he's the engineer because he knows how to work batteries and use a screwdriver and pick a lock.
I really want Apple to do a commercial with this movie, with the characters from this movie. Like, here's how you charge your iPod. And he's like got two electrodes hooked up to it. And he's got like this steampunk bullshit that he's just cranking in the background.
You know, this reminds me, it's a segue here for a second. This is one.
Digging into the potatoes for a second.
This movie is part of the reason I got out of film blogging. I loved this movie. And IO9 ran a piece 3 days before the movie came out about whether or not the iPod, it was feasible that the iPod could still work, and wrote an entire essay that started off with, I haven't seen this movie yet, but I talked to enough people that I think I understand enough to write a 10-paragraph essay on the survivability of an iPod and why this movie doesn't make any sense.
To quote a line from this movie, cursed be the ground for our sake. Are you fucking kidding me with this?
No, no. And it was like, and it was one of those things where that kind of, after I read that article, I started seeing articles like this everywhere and realized that clickbait was taking over film criticism. And I'm like, I got to get the fuck out. I got to get the fuck out of here. I can't do this.
Oppenheimer of the internet journalism here. I've become massa worm, destroyer of worlds.
Destroyer of plot holes. And sure enough, soon after, we started seeing think pieces on, like, how did Batman get back to Gotham? Fuck you. You know the answer. He's Batman.
Yeah, he actually hopped hopped the midnight don't give a shit express.
Yeah. It's like, this is,
he flew,
like,
MacGuffin Airlines.
This is cinema. This is, you know, cinema is impressionistic.
He went across the suspension bridge of disbelief. Shut up.
Yeah. But that was this movie triggered that for me, because it's like, look, I watching the movie, the iPod is representative of something that works, you know, that functions story-wise. Could it exist 30 years in the future and the battery still work? I believe feasibly enough that it could, you know, physically, could it have? Does it matter for the story? Could we have found another way to have done it? Sure, possibly. But it was, you know, they were establishing a time and a place and who this character was, and do it in a fantastic way. So that's what I care about. But yeah, yes,
ask me if his iPod could have still worked after the apocalypse.
Could it have worked?
It doesn't matter if his iPod could have worked after the apocalypse.
You know what? Because he doesn't need the iPod to finish the story or the movie. Just happens. All the iPod does is humanize him and gives him a reason when he's at the fork of the road to go to the city rather than walk past, because he wants to go, and all he wants is to fucking charge up his battery and be on his way. That's all he wants.
Well,
like, this is where we get the classic Western element of this film. He is a guy who wanders into town and doesn't want any trouble, and trouble finds him.
Yeah, and actually reminded me, there's a shot in this movie where he literally is in sort of the high noon stature of, like, being in the middle of the street and being surrounded by bad guys, and he's taking them all out one by one. Like, he's the Magnificent One. Like, it's just him, and he's mowing down an army of banditos.
Are you talking about the shootout, or are you talking about the knife scene?
So many to choose from, right? Because he does it multiple times in the movie.
Well, and each way is done in a different, like, is riffing on a different director and doing its own thing. Like, that scene I love that scene in Under the Bridge at the very beginning when realize this is, you know, not this is a swordsman movie.
This is the Wu-Tang moment where you find out he's nothing to fuck with.
It is very much the Kill Bill shadow fight sequence crossed with the hammer sequence from Old Boy.
Oh, yeah.
And
if that doesn't get your nerd dick hard,
and
just hearing
glorious.
That.
But the thing is Gary Whitta's hard as nails fucking dialogue leading up to that, when the guy goes and touches Denzel Washington, most alpha fucking man in acting today, our fucking Lee Marvin.
Yeah.
When he is our fucking Lee Marvin, and dear God, a guy puts his hand on him, and Denzel Washington says, you put that hand on me again, you're not getting it back.
Speaking of the apocalypse, he's not just the alpha male, he's the alpha and omega man.
So the guy goes and puts his hand on him again, and this giant fucking terrifying fucking blade comes out in a flash, cutting the hand off.
Even Rambo would call this blade a bit much.
The guy starts screaming, hits the ground, and then, again, smart as hell Gary Whitta dialogue, starts speaking gibberish.
Yeah.
And this is something you just don't see in movies.
No, he's never seen this before.
He starts speaking gibberish, and they're like, what did he say? And Denzel Washington goes, he's in shock. I think he said, kill him. And then Denzel Washington steps back into the shadow of the bridge, and then we get this amazing fucking short but sweet fucking scene where he just mows them all down. And this is where also I'm going to drop the second major spoiler.
Well, before you do, that moment, I watched that scene and I remember thinking, in any other film, this step back into the shadows wouldn't just be stylistic, but it'd be practical as well, so that you could hide your stunt double. But something about the way he was doing that, I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's still Denzel. And I looked it up, and sure enough, Denzel did all his own stunts for this movie and trained with Bruce Lee's protege in martial arts. And it's like, yeah, you can tell that's still Denzel Washington. There is a performance even in the fight moments.
Yeah.
And fucking A, man.
Yes. And they are great. But here is the big thing, the other shoe to drop, the thing many of you who have seen the movie have been waiting for us to mention and talk about. He's blind.
And that's crazy to me, because that exact fight sequence, which, by the way, is shot gorgeously.
Oh, this entire movie is gorgeous.
Holy shit, the cinematography on this movie.
The cinematography plus the intense desaturation of all the colors to make it look like it is a world, our world baked in sun. Is so good.
Yeah, and that moment, though, that fight sequence, I kept saying, I had the thought, man, this is like a Zatoichi movie, except he's not blind. And the movie fooled me the entire time.
And the thing is, and this is the masterstroke of this movie, of all the things I find genius about this film, the masterstroke of this movie is how well they conceal that he is blind, and yet how out in the open they are about him being blind. Because when you know he's blind and you go back and watch this movie, you see him react to everything that way.
There's an entire section of the trivia for this movie that just breaks down all the things that you could have noticed. And that's the thing that's not mentioned that I think is further interesting about the iPod is like, what it is as far as like which version of the iPod, whether it still works, is inconsequential, because all it really is so the audience sees him doing something with his free time that isn't reading. Mm-hmm. That's all that is.
Well,
that's all that is.
Except that once you know he's blind, you know that he doesn't see the world as it is. When he listens to his music, he can see the world as it was.
Well, and he literally is now a blind prophet.
Yes. Yes.
So,
like this movie has so many layers and so much depth to it. But
and you thought those sunglasses were just cool.
So to take it even further, and here's the thing that I absolutely love about this. If you have never watched this movie for the second time in a theater or on a television with a great, you know, TV with a great sound system backing it up, you have not truly experienced the genius of this movie. Because this movie, the sound design of this movie, they put the sounds in the proper speakers of where they're located in the room, mm-hmm. so that you too get that experience of hearing how he's hearing and echolocating. Like when you hear the clink of a glass when he's trying to zero in on somebody, and you hear it out of the back left speaker, and he turns his head that direction, you're like, oh shit. And this whole movie is designed like that. Every fight scene is designed with super meticulous sound design so that you are in that moment with him and it all works for you and you understand how he's doing it, because they are very, very careful about setting that up and making it function as well as it needs to function. Because then it comes to the next big thing that we have to talk about with this and put this all together in this giant stew of awesomeness.
Gather it in one leather-bound tome, as it were.
There may or may not be a god in this movie, and Eli may or may not actually be divinely pointed in the direction he is, and God may or may not be looking after him. So all of these things that have happened to lead Eli here may in fact be a fantasy element to this film or a faith-driven element to this film, depending on what you believe.
Yeah.
And that's just crazy. So we have a Zatoichi movie.
Yes.
In which Zatoichi is carrying the Bible and may in fact be God's divine servant here solely to deliver a Bible to the right person at the right time so that humanity has it for its future.
And see, here's what I think is great about that. I think you don't have to have a lick of faith to appreciate his quest. No. I think there is a righteousness in his quest that that transcends religion.
And he, but the thing is again, I will keep using the word genius because I honestly feel this movie's true genius on all levels, from writing to directing to sound design to cinematography. Like, this is just a big, amazing stew of genius. You don't have to believe that for that story to work. You also don't have to believe it in order for the physics to work. Like, it is right. Just a Zatoichi movie. Like, we have there, for those of you that keep hearing us use the word Zatoichi, if you have never watched a Zatoichi movie, there are many. There, you know, there was a wonderful remake several years back that's
Beat
a great
Takashi.
That is a great way to start off. There are, I think, 26.
See, and here's what's great. I had only seen enough Zatoichi movies to know why the ending of Beat Takashi's movie is fucking amazing.
Yes. Yes. But there is, there are, I think, 26.
He's their James Bond. He's Japan's James Bond.
Yeah, that is the way to put it.
Yeah.
That is the best way to describe it. And Japan's James Bond just happens to be a blind swordsman who keeps wandering into towns when they need him most, and who always fights for the weaker, the oppressed. And it's an amazing series. If you've never delved into Zatoichi, he's one of the great heroes of the world. He's one of the greatest heroes of all time. And this is the Hughes brothers making a modern Zatoichi movie and infusing faith.
Yeah.
And it is fucking amazing how they blend all of those things while at the same time, and again, this is just how much depth there is in this movie. As much as there is faith and belief tied into God, the antagonist of this movie is someone who wants to use religion to oppress people and for power. So this movie is not your classic Christian narrative.
I think this is tremendously, at the most diplomatic, I'll say it's secular. And honestly, I think there are parts of this movie that feel, I don't want to say anti-religious, but definitely have a very practical eye toward the danger of religion.
And that's what is great about a perfectly executed think piece, is it can be something to anybody. If I show this movie to my parents, I don't know if they've seen it. If I show this movie to my parents, who are devout Catholics, they would be like, wow.
Obvious Christian parable. Or obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my dad would talk about how he wishes he had seen this film 7 years ago so that he could relate to the kids in his catechism class. So like, it's like in the Book of Eli, when Eli goes and does this, like, this is that kind of a movie. Whereas, you know, the only person I knew that hated this movie based upon that element, it was a rabid secular humanist at the time. He has since come around, but at the time, a friend of ours was very deeply angry. He was, and we called him a born again secular humanist, which he wrote off at the time. And now I was like, oh yeah, no, I totally was. I was totally a dick. I was like trying to tell everybody. And now I just, you know, I just believe what I believe and you believe what you believe. But at the time he hated it because he's like the Bible even intimating that the Bible might actually have power and that God might exist.
And that's ridiculous to me because
this movie doesn't say anything.
No, and in fact, it says the opposite of that. Maybe not the opposite. Opposite's too strong a word. One of the last shots of this movie is a newly formed Bible being placed on a shelf immediately between the Quran and the Torah.
Yeah.
It's about the preservation of knowledge.
It's about the preservation of what made us us.
The preservation of humanity through the written word. This movie isn't so much for Christians as it is bibliophiles. Like, that's really what this movie is. But you're right. It could work for
either. The thing is there's so much depth here. There are so many layers. It is so open to interpretation at times without being imperceptibly vague, you know, without being impenetrable.
Or on the flip side, despite the fact that it's the Bible, without being preachy.
Yeah, it could have been very heavy-handed. It's not.
It's and in fact, there's a moment in this movie where I feel like there are as many hints in this movie that it's not really about the tenets of Christianity as there are clues that he's blind. And one of my favorites is he starts quoting this this line where he says, faith is the flower of light in the field of darkness that's giving me the strength to carry on. And Solara says, is that from your book? And he says, no, it's Johnny Cash live at Folsom Prison.
which you now know must be on his iPod.
Yes, which one is on his iPod. Two shows that he is absorbing knowledge from other areas, not just the Bible. And three is an awesome fucking foreshadowing of where this movie's going.
Oh, yes. To a prison.
To
Alcatraz. Like, there's so much here.
The philosophical, like, beyond religion, the philosophical elements of this movie are what I loved most about it, where it's like, the best we can hope for is that he gets to a prison that now contains all of the artifacts. Like, one of the sterling examples of the worst of humanity is its prisons, right? And not only that, but the worst of where a society is. If you really, I think it's probably Tolstoy or Dostoevsky that said, if you really want to know where a society is, like, look at its prisons. And this, it's fucking Alcatraz, for God's sake. It is the prison. It's the Rock. And that is where this group of people are housing all, not just books, but all of these works of art and all of these documentations of what life used to be and what humanity used to be within the walls of Alcatraz. Somebody get Alanis Morissette on the phone, because that is fucking irony at its best.
And the beauty of that scene where we meet the curator.
Yes. I kept wanting to say Roddy.
Yeah,
but it's Malcolm.
It's Malcolm. It's Malcolm McDowell. To when he's like, how excited he is that we have the complete works of Shakespeare and Britannica, mm-hmm. almost all the volumes intact. Like, this is the extent of human knowledge of what's left behind is most of an Encyclopedia Britannica collection. Like, it is kind of crazy what has happened to the earth, that this is, and so to have a Bible, to have a complete Bible, is miraculous. It's worth what ends up happening, him scribbling down the entire book.
Yeah.
And of course, giving us our title, quite literally, the Bible now being the Book of Eli, you know, the book that Eli transcribes, while also being the Book of Eli, the story of how the Bible was carried for 30 years on the back of a blind man.
See, but that title wouldn't fit on the posters. Right. They shortened it.
But man, oh man, oh man, oh fucking man, do all of these pieces fit together wonderfully? And it's such a simple movie. It's a classic Western tale with a Zatoichi element, which, interestingly enough, the Zatoichi stories, much like the Seven Samurai, borrow heavily from our Westerns. And it's being retranslated back, which I find amazing.
You know what else has been translated over and over and over and over again? The fucking Bible.
The Bible. So we're getting this really cool kind of modern samurai film mixed with a religious epic, mixed with a Western, mixed with a post-apocalyptic movie. And it hits all of those elements perfectly. Mm-hmm. And it's very simple in terms of story. There isn't a lot of story here. Literally.
No, it's thin on the ground for sure.
Yeah. Except that, because it's all dense with character. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a movie that is developing character very simply, very effectively, and then using a lot of great visuals with amazing cinematography.
And we haven't even talked about the score.
We have not gotten to the score yet. We haven't even named off all the actors yet.
No.
Let's finish off the cast here, because Gary Oldman runs the town.
He plays a character named Carnegie.
And then he's got his second in command,
the Punisher. Commissioner Gordon has the Punisher working for him.
Yes, that is exactly where I was going.
Fucking amazing.
Ray Stevenson. Yeah, Ray Stevenson, who has surprisingly more depth than most henchmen.
Than the guy with the mohawk from Road Warrior.
What's fascinating is he seems like the general brutish thug. Who's just there to question our leader and offer a little sanity into the insanity. Because this guy's not, he keeps sending out men to find this fucking book. And it's just a book. And I don't understand. Why do you care about a book? I gave you, you have a desk full of books. Why do you need this one book? He doesn't understand. But, you know, as things start getting more and more desperate, he's like, look, I'll do it if I can do it for Solara. Because again, the leading back to what I never really got to come around to, you've got the most beautiful woman in the wasteland, like here with all of these brutish thugs, but no one will touch her. And in fact, there's like this weird throwaway moment where Carnegie is just like, well, I guess we'll finally get some real use out of her.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, wow, that's a really kind of weird thing to do. That when it's seeing the alternate casting they had, I see how that could have been played and made slightly more sense. Mm-hmm. But he ends up demanding Solara. And then you're like, okay, typical thuggish, rapey, I want this girl, can't have this girl, I want her. Okay. But when she has her life threatened, he's genuinely disturbed by it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's this look on Ray Stevenson's face of like, heartbreak. Like, no, you can't threaten. And it wasn't the, no, she is mine. It's, this guy genuinely has feelings for this girl. Mm-hmm. Like, she hates him because he's a fucking terrible thug who's, you know, pretty much around to keep her mother in line, who's kept as a pet by Carnegie.
Her mother played by Jennifer Beals.
Yes, Jennifer Beals, fucking doing a great job. Everybody's great in this movie.
And I love the fact, oh my God, the more I think about this now, the fact that Jennifer Beals' character is blind is kind of like in old like 70s shows where a guy would book two dates and then he'd book them at the same restaurant. The almost arrogance of the fact that you have a character in the movie you're trying to keep the audience from knowing is blind, and then you write another character who's obviously blind and you make them interact, like that is like pushing the envelope. That's like, not only do my parents not know that I'm home alone, but I'm gonna throw a party just for the fuck of it. Like, you are really trying to get in trouble.
And yet they pull it off.
They pull it off really well.
And that scene, when you know what's going on in it, has a lot more depth to it. Like that, the look on his face and the way he, when Denzel Washington starts tapping on his chest to tell her where he is.
Yeah.
Has a certain connection to it that is just wonderful. Like, it's just a subtlety that went into this movie is so subtle about all the things it does. It's a movie that should be in your face, that should be ham-fisted, it should be heavy-handed, and it's not. Like, yeah. And I don't mean because of the talent involved, I mean because this type of movie, that's typically what you get, and instead you get two masters like the Hughes brothers who have such an interesting and weird fucking career.
Yeah, Menace to Society was their big breakout movie.
Yeah, and then they make a movie like every 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And they just have such a weird history. Like, that, I wanted, like, did they get like some huge motherfucking payday and they live like, you know, ordinary, you know, very middle class lives so that they can live almost indefinitely off it and only make a movie every so often? Or are they doing something behind the scenes? Is it like a Phil Alden Robinson where they're actually like, you know, really well paid secret script doctors? Mm-hmm. What is it? Like, how do they get by? I don't fucking know, but they get by, and then they keep coming out and they make something like this, and then they vanished again, and they've got a new movie coming out this year.
That takes place in the fucking Ice Age.
Yeah. Because these guys are fucking awesome. Like, they did From Hell,
luckily,
which is not a good movie.
No, but I mean, no.
That was their big misfire.
Yeah, and it's like, it's the one Ice Age movie that Ray Romano's not going to be involved in, so I'll probably see it. So that's something definitely to brag about. But there's so many moments in this movie. Actually, here's the thing I want to ask. Because the one thing that did mess with my head a little bit while I was watching this is, are they trying to say that no one... I kept thinking about, so this is 30 years after the Great War and the obvious, you know, zero event that wiped everybody out. But the way that Gary Oldman talks about the Bible and the way this little town seems to, like, there's so many people in this little town that don't seem to know what the fuck it even is. are they really trying to suggest that 30 years from now, like, we wouldn't know what the Bible is? Or is the assumption that most of the people in this town are under the age of 30?
There, most of the people in this town were only children when, like, you look at, like, Ray Stevenson. Ray Stevenson was probably, what, like, 40 when he made this movie?
Yeah.
You know, his character's in his late 30s, early 40s. This is 30 winters later. This kid was 7 to 10 when this happened. And if he wasn't raised in a religious family, fuck would he know? I mean, if he's only supposed to be playing a 30-year-old guy,
I guess I get that, but it's like, you think about all the hotels that have them in every room, like, it is not hard to get your hands on a Bible.
Except that they actually say that line in the movie. You know, they say, they, you know, the book was blamed for starting the war, so they collected them all up and burned them all. Like, that was the thing, is they were all burned because the book was seen as dangerous, because that's telling us that this was a religious war. Like, whatever this war was a religious nuclear war. And as a result, the survivors destroyed the existing ones. And the reason why this one wasn't destroyed was nobody thought to seek out the Braille copy that was in this.
The Holy
library.
Braille, you might say, is what this
the
book
Holy
is.
The Holy Braille.
It's the Holy Braille.
You know what? I would not be surprised if that was a in-joke on the set or while Widow was writing it, where he's just snickering to himself, the Holy Braille. Entirely possible.
Yeah. But, you know, what's crazy is even at the end of the movie, when, you know, they're driving one way and Gary Oldman's got the book and he's trying to open him, like, it's going to be blank. It's going to be blank. It's going to be blank. He opens it up and he's like, he has the look on his face, like, yeah, it's blank, isn't it, motherfucker? And then he look at him like, it's
Yeah. And then you rewind the whole movie in your head and you're like, oh my God.
My coffee cup hit the floor. It said Kobayashi on the bottom.
When he's and it adds context to certain scenes that play one way and then play a totally different way when you watch them again. Like scene when he's being shot at and he walks away.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he doesn't know where everybody is. Like, he has no idea where people are. So he knows that if he doesn't have a choice. Like, he just, at that point, you see it in on his face. Lord, I'm going to do this. You said you'd protect me. The voice said I would get there. So I'm going to just walk now. And I hope you're protecting me now. And then sure enough, he is protected. In fact, there's one shot in here I've never been able to fully put together. It looks like he gets shot, but it doesn't actually hit him. So I'm not sure if he's grazed or if, you know, I'm not sure exactly what it is that happens, but it looks like he catches a shot in the chest, but he's fine. So I don't know. In that moment in particular, that's the only shot in the movie that I'm not entirely sure if I'm just seeing things or if it's supposed to be a graze but either way, that scene where he's walking away because he can't figure out where they are. Yeah. Like, and you also, and again, the elegance of this screenplay where, you know, when somebody says he's got a gun on his pack and he's like, it's not, one of the other jackers says, it's not loaded, though. They're never loaded. It's like, oh, so many people carry around guns and don't have any ammunition anymore. So, because it's 30 years later and they fired off all their ammunition. So it's, oh, so yeah, a swordsman could survive in the wasteland that way and not be shot. But here they have hoarded ammunition and then we have a real gunfight. But it turns out he does have some bullets left.
Speaking of bullets and other things that make this movie great, we mentioned the cinematography. The parts where it really just dazzled me are in those gunfights, because I have never seen... There's a shootout where it literally follows in one sweeping circular motion, and I'm not talking about the carousel O camera like Michael Bay uses. I'm talking about one fluid shot where you see bullet from gun to target, and then it comes back around and shows from target back to gun.
Yeah.
It is astounding. I've never seen anything like it. And it's so, like, everything about this movie is beautifully shot, and that score, it sounds like the Vangelis score from fucking Blade Runner.
Yeah.
It is like it's trippy and 80s, but not overly synth. It's like melodically synth.
Everything about this movie ages well.
Yeah.
Like it is, you know, a lot of times when you do something slick and different and cutting edge, it feels very dated. But the Hughes brothers were zagging when everyone else was zigging and created something that just keeps aging so well and showing that it was an outlier and a very special film doing its own thing. We were talking about gunfights to continue that. Mm-hmm. That gunfight at the end with Michael Gambone and I'm forgetting the actress's name.
Both of them, by the way, both him and the actress who plays his wife in that movie play characters in the Harry Potter universe.
Yes.
So it's pretty funny.
Yes, they are Potterverse folks. But yeah, but also, again, more of the subtlety of the movie, you know, the whole movie, we have people ask Denzel Washington to stick out his hands.
Yes.
Because there is a very real thing that...
It's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
Yes. For eating other human beings, you develop Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And so cannibals have the shakes. And so they want to see your hand to see if you have the shakes. They want to find out if you're a cannibal or not. So they keep checking, and we never meet fucking cannibals until the end. And we have this old woman carrying tea, and she's got the shakes. But you don't think anything of it because she's an old woman.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, and if you're paying attention, you're like, oh, these guys and their Wile E. Coyote traps, they must be cannibals. If you don't catch that, it's referenced a little later. It's like, did you see it? And they're like, she had the shakes. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's like, oh, holy shit, I was totally not paying attention.
Why did they have to notice it on a tea tray? Because Denzel wouldn't have seen it, but he could have heard it when she was carrying that tray. Like, it's so fucking good.
Exactly.
So fucking good.
Yes. And so, yeah. And then, of course, that's when the posse rolls up. And, of course, these guys are fucking loaded for bear and armed to the teeth.
Yeah. There was a sign on the way up to the door that said, Make America Great Again. So.
And it has, and my favorite joke of the whole movie, because it's not a very funny movie. It's not a movie with a lot of humor in it.
It's not a laugh riot.
Well, you know, a lot of dark movies, like the Road Warrior movies, have some funny elements to them. They've got some clever dialogue.
And I will say that
they've
even
got a comic relief character that this movie doesn't have.
And even movies like The Equalizer have moments of levity. Speaking of age well, why do people keep thinking they can fuck with older Denzel Washington? When are they going to learn that that's not a good idea?
Yeah, you cannot. That said... one of the funnier elements is when we're with these old people and they go to put on some music, and they go and get one of those old crank records and they crank it up and it starts up, and you're expecting, because you've seen this machine a dozen times, one of these old 1910, mm-hmm. 1920s songs to come up, and then all of a sudden, you can ring my bell, ring my bell, ring my bell. Ring a ding a ding.
Yeah, you're expecting Eddie Cantor, and you get Anita Ward.
And the way all the dates work together, of course, that's the music these old people listen to. Yeah. They were disco people in the 70s. That's so fucking great.
If I start a band, the name is going to be Disco on the Victrola, because that's exactly what we get in this scene, is Disco on the Victrola.
It's really fucking great. And that moment is just really adorable and funny in a movie that otherwise have very few light spots.
Yeah. It's not the joke book of Eli.
Yeah.
As it turns out.
But yeah, but that's Book of Eli. Like, Book of Eli is just this incredibly dense, wonderful movie that asks you to peel layer after layer after layer. If you're one of those people that watched it and was turned off by the fact that he was blind the first time you saw it and then wrote it off, I highly recommend rewatching it knowing he's blind and see the subtlety there and the world that they're setting up, and then just peel layer after layer after layer off this movie, because dear God, there's just so much here. It is such a smart movie. It is such a well-crafted movie. It was one of my top 10 movies of 2010. Like, it was, it made my top 10 list. It is a movie that I own, that I travel with. It's one of my, along with Flash Gordon, one of my 3 a.m. movies when I've had a couple scotches and I'm no good to watch something new that I really care about, but I want to sit down with a comfort classic and just watch. This is one of those movies I pop on and pour another glass of scotch and just go, all right, Denzel. Denzel. Let's watch you fuck some motherfuckers up for 2 hours. Wonderful, wonderful fucking film. And one of my junk food favorites.
We're out of the ground. We were taken for the dust we are. And to the dust we shall return.
And before we close the book on this episode, we of course have to do the junk food pairing.
Here it is. I've been waiting for the shoe to drop for an hour now. Let's... what the fuck did you cook up for this week?
So if you've ever been on a long road trip and you've gotten to sort of the outskirts of where you're convinced any humans would actually live, and you don't think anyone resides in these little towns, but what you do know, even if you're blind, you can clearly hear the rumble of your stomach. You are famished, and you pull into the first little place you can find, and it just so happens to be a mom and pop barbecue place, and you know that when you get that combination plate, you can't immediately place the animal that the meat is from, but you're so fucking hungry and you're so out of the way, you are so on the fringe of the rest of civilization that you just tear into it. You don't know if you're eating beef, you don't know if you're eating cat, you could be eating people. You could have pulled into
the hotel hell,
the motel hell, absolutely. But you eat it anyway, and it's the best barbecue you've ever had, and you go away questioning a lot about yourself, but not questioning how good that meal was. So middle of nowhere barbecue is this week's junk food pairing. I also love the fact that the only real product placements in this movie are Busch beer, which is being crushed under the weight of a freeway overpass, yeah, which is exactly what should happen to Busch beer, and KFC... being the only source of Denzel Washington's bathing while on this trip.
And Apple.
Apple? Oh, the iPod, of course.
Yeah, the plot point. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But it's
because everything else is destroyed.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah.
But KFC, I'm sorry, Demolition Man, it is not Taco Bell that survived the fast food wars. It was apparently KFC.
That's right.
Because where is he getting all those moist towelettes, I ask you? And that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back next week. Of course, that is if the world has not ended. But if it hasn't, we'll be back with more episodes of movies that we love that either haven't gotten enough play or there's a reason people don't like it, but we do anyway. So until then, if you want to find us, you can do so. You can get our back catalog on iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like what we're doing here, if you really want this to continue until 2043.
If you'd like half an hour more of us this week.
Yes, go to Patreon, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and give for as little as $4 a month. You will get access to some very high quality bonus content that we do just for our patrons. And I've had several of them tell us they look forward to those bonus episodes as much as the regular episodes. So we will be doing reviews of new movies that come out. We'll be doing top five lists. We'll be doing mailbag episodes.
We might have something special this week. During this episode, ooh, yes, I came up with something special.
Ooh.
So we may, if after we get off mic, have something really special this week. I don't know. We'll find out. But you can only find out by dropping as little as a dollar a week at patreon.com.
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On the Twitters, at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And to wrap up the show, to read from the good book, I want to remind you that from Dorito dust we are, and to the Dorito dust we shall return. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the